the innovations that came up during lockdown were incredible to me. You know, I think there were so many of us that just totally rethought, well, what are, you know, when you strip it all away, what are the bare bones of what we do? And what we need is communion with each other. And if we've got that, we're all going to be much healthier, much happier human beings, I think.
Hello, and welcome to episode 49 of Attention Engineer. I'm Laura, and this is my podcast. Hi. Attention Engineer is a show where I share deep conversations with fellow artists about creativity, grit, and determination. My aim is to consistently remind you and remind myself that creativity really is for everyone. I definitely need that reminder, and having these conversations has been an incredible boost over the past year and a bit. Thank you for being part of this. The rain is hammering down in Bristol today after weeks of balmy weather. I hope you can hear it. I think it makes the launch pad feel extra cozy. I took an adventure week off recently and started open water swimming. Wow. I was immediately hooked and have been going regularly ever since. And it's so interesting when you start doing something new how easy it is now to find others who love that thing too. Thanks, internet. I've always had great admiration for anyone who follows their interest in life, anyone who loves something, however obscure that thing is, so much that their eyes gleam when they talk about it. I played shows fairly relentlessly between 2010 and 2019, around 600 in total, and a gig didn't really feel like a gig unless I got a chance to meet people afterwards and talk with them, about them. Compliments are lovely, of course, but as Tom Robinson said in episode 6, they close off a conversation pretty quickly. I love your music. Thank you. Or, wow, you're, insert famous name here. Yes, yes I am. The end. This podcast has given me the opportunity to move right past the compliment stage and ask probing questions of some of the artists I admire the most, leading to some really fascinating and personally enriching conversations. I could never have predicted the glittering guest list this show has had so far. And as I near the end of this phase of Attention Engineer, I'm feeling very grateful to you for tuning in. Thank you for encouraging me by turning up to listen. This show passed 40,000 downloads last week, and I'm just so pleased that the idea I cooked up in my home studio has entertained and informed you through some of the strangest times in recent history. Thank you to every single guest. And a huge thanks also to every member of my Correspondence Club for their generous support. I genuinely couldn't have done this without you. Today's guest was meant to be one of the first names on that illustrious guest list, but as it is, the timing worked out for the best because, in her words, if we had talked last March, she wouldn't have had anything to say. No danger of that in this episode, thankfully. Just a lovely opportunity to catch up with a friend from the road just before her new album comes out next Monday. A folk singer, songwriter, and activist from Leicester, UK, Grace Petrie has been writing, recording, and touring relentlessly for more than 10 years. Her unique takes on life, love, and politics, and the warmth and wit with which they are delivered, have won over audiences everywhere across the alternative, folk, political, and comedy scenes. Through all of this, Grace has quietly become one of the most respected songwriters working in the UK today. Grace's new album, Connectivity, is out on the 4th of October 2021 and is available to buy now. Please join me for my conversation with Grace Petrie.
I'm actually quite used to all that stuff. I only just, like, in the last sort of 3 years, learned how to, like, ask a sound engineer for what I actually need and mean. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But I think it was a confidence thing.
Yeah. But, it takes a while, doesn't it?
Well, it will be unsurprising to you to hear that I'm quite bad at, like, anything admin-y. I'm just, like, incredibly disorganized about. So for years and years and years, I would just get up and I'd get there and people would, like, already be quite stressed. They'd be like, we don't know what tech you need. And I would always just be like, yeah, it's just that I need, like, basically nothing. Like, I know you'll have it. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you have a single microphone in this building, like, I can use it. If you have anywhere that I can plug a jack lead into and hear my guitar, then, like, we're fine. And then they'd always be this, like, kind of, we'd start on a foot of like real confrontation because the sound engineer would be like, we just don't know what you need. And I'd be like, yeah, I just need like the bare minimum. And then they'd sort of be like, well, that's okay. And I'd be like, yeah, I know. I knew it would be.
But today could have been the day you turned up with the full orchestra there, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Could have been that day. True.
And also, like, I learned my lesson because one fateful trade union event I played where they said to me in advance, and I had told them in advance, I said, I just need a mic and a DI. Does that sound like a normal sentence to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, but... What you forget is, and what I learned that day, is that that assumes a lot of things about the event, like there will be a PA. And it was in this like little pub in Birmingham, and I turned up and there was nobody there, and there was no stage, and there was no, it was just like those small pubs that are on the corners of terrace streets that are like L-shaped pubs. And I got in there and I was like, there's nowhere obvious that a gig would even be happening here. And then the woman turned up and she was like, she was so lovely and she was so warm. And she was like, oh, by the way, before I forget, I've got these for you. Reached into her bag and pulled out a microphone, like no lead, just like handed it to me, and a DI box. No, and I was like, to be fair, that'll teach me to ask for a mic and a DI. That's what I've got. And I was like, wow. Yeah, these are... I can't do anything with these. It looks like I'm going unplugged tonight. We're just going to sit in the corner of this pub.
Oh my.
Yeah.
What was the gig like in the end?
Mate, very strange. It was like, okay. do you know Bethany Black, the comic?
I've heard the name.
Yeah, yeah. She was like, I saw that she was on the bill. So I was like, oh, like, if she's doing it, it must be legit. And then she later confessed to me that she saw that I was on the bill and thought this. We both like agreed to do this thing, thinking like they must know what they're doing. And then like she got there and she's like, so there's no PA, huh? And I was like, no. And then they sort of like managed to, the pub itself had like a karaoke machine, which they like gave her the like one of those like real bad like kids karaoke machines with like terrible like microphone that sounds like a loudspeaker. And they gave that to her, like plugged into the karaoke machine, like no stand or anything. They're like, if you're on a mic stand, I'm sure we can fashion something. So they like gaffer taped this microphone to the handle of a mop that was like leaning on top of it. And me and her were like, blimey, it is
Jesus.
This business we call show, eh? It's like still, and but it like, it was the first time I'd met her and it like really bonded us. It was like a real war story. So yeah,
oh, wow.
It was one for the memoir.
I've had two experiences like that, one of which, luckily, we figured it out beforehand that they weren't going to have a PA. I think they wanted me to bring one. And I was like, I'm not like a weekend disco. Like, I don't have that stuff. I mean, also, I don't really, like, I can set that stuff up. I absolutely can do that. But I'd really rather just focus on the performing bit because there's quite a lot to that as well.
Yeah, that's like a different job, isn't it? That's like totally above and beyond.
Yeah, it is. But then when it's like, it's almost like implicitly expected, or when someone doesn't understand what the gear is, it feels to me like I'm just sort of being really rude and going, well, no, I won't do my own sound. Like it's bad. Yeah. Awkward.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. And I was like, I felt so bad with this woman that I was like, I've made so many assumptions about what you might know about putting something on like this. And they were just trade unionists. They weren't event organizers or promoters or anything. Do you know what I mean?
But it's hard to know in an email, isn't it?
It's very hard to know. And when they're like, what tech do you need? And now these days I'm like, I would feel incredibly condescending saying, I need a PA. This is what that means. There needs to be some form of amplification, you know, probably an engineer to manage these things.
Jesus Christ, who do you think you are?
I'm going to be joined by this guy, I'm afraid, because he is
Frank,
continuing his 2-year streak of not allowing me to do any Zoom calls that he's not the star of. Frank. So, do you know what? After joking about my technical prowess, I haven't been recording this. Sorry.
Well, I have, so it's fine. But feel free. get involved. I'll send a PA system around. So I love our opener about PA systems. I was looking at when we first met. I think it must have been Chris TT's Midwinter Picnic in 2012.
That sounds about right, at West Hill Hall, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
in Brighton.
I think
That was a gorgeous day. Yeah.
It was so great. Yeah. And I hadn't heard of you before that, I don't think. I don't remember that I had. But I remember watching you play, and just from the very moment, the first note, first, you know, first anything you did, was just completely hooked on what you were doing.
Oh, thank you.
It was so impressive to me. And I think this must be before I went on tour with Chris. It was just before. And I remember spending a lot of time in the car with him talking about what live performance is for, and like how you can make it your own thing, obviously. You can make it whatever you want. But having a bit of intention about it helps. So I did a lot of sort of soul searching, because I've been doing a lot of gigs before that, playing other people's bands. And that was all about, I just want to play music and learn my instrument and learn my craft. And then it was like playing music for money, because I was hired to play for people. So then it becomes a job. Yeah, there's that aspect to it as well. But just spending a lot of time thinking, like, what am I doing this for? I found that really interesting. I was wondering if you had a moment that became clear for you, if that's something you spent time on, how intentional the way you perform live is.
I mean, it's a funny question to be asking me at the moment, though, to be honest, because it's...
Do you remember?
Well, I was going to say, I feel like I'm having it now. I suppose because I always wrote songs about politics, and Billy Bragg was a big influence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I was like, I'm 34, and I was like, my first record was like 2010, and that was like just after the first Conservative government got in, Cameron's government. And I wrote loads of songs about politics, and I was part of, and I guess then I would have been like 20, in my early 20s, 22 or something. And so I was sort of, and I had loads of friends who were at uni, and I was kind of working at the time at the Sheffield University Students Union bar. And I was quite involved in like the protest, the like student protest scene, that kind of was initially sparked by like tuition fees and Nick Clegg, and but spiraled into like a massive sort of kind of joined, I think, the wider anti-austerity movement. And I was really inspired like all the time about politics back then. And it felt like those first couple of years, you know, though, it just felt like we were like marching all the time, and there's demos all the time. And it was like Occupy St. Paul's, and it felt like this incredibly fertile time politically. You know, and it really felt like the songs, you know, I think looking back, I think ridiculously naively, I thought, you know, they could really be an important part of that sort of thing. But it was very self-fulfilling, because the more I didn't really know very much about politics when I first started with all that stuff. But the more I went to, the more demos I went to, the more people would come up to me and say, have you heard about this story, this injustice, this politician, this whatever, like, you should write a song about it. So then I'd be like, sure, and then I'd just go off and learn about it. And so I wrote like 2 or 3 albums worth of songs, mostly political material, in those first, like, between 2010 and 2013. I was doing like a DIY record like a year almost. I don't want to be too much of a downer straight away, but you know, I've never here we are 11 years later, and I have never been like less politically optimistic, I suppose, about where we stand in terms of this country and like the wider political direction of like any kind of movement for social justice. It feels like it's been quite willfully and deliberately like stamped out in, certainly in the Labour Party and in a wider sense in this country. And it's a funny thing to sort of like sit and think about like where that leaves me. Like, it's not the most important part of the conversation for social justice.
But what about me?
But as a as an artist, I sort of like, I always wanted to be a musician before I ever was in any way doing anything that could be called protest songs. You know, yeah. I knew I wanted to be a singer when I was like a teenager, before I knew anything at all about politics. Then I kind of got involved in politics, and it really felt like it was very comforting to me to feel like, you know, wow, I'm being an activist. You know, that made me feel great about myself. Like, I'm being part of the revolution. And now, you know, I think I see like people coming up like 10, 15 years younger than me who are writing amazing songs, amazing urgent political songs, and that's like absolutely their job and their place. And like, I just feel like I'm so burnt out politically, and I still want to be a musician, you know, and I'm always going to want to be a musician, but it makes me feel like a bit of a fraud to sort of turn around. I've got this new record, which is like my sort of seventh album, depending on who you talk to. It's like either my seventh or my second album, but it's like my second like studio album.
How is it your second? You've done so many.
Yeah, I know. Like Queer as Folk was the first one that actually like was done in a studio, basically.
Oh, I see. So that's how you're classing it.
Well, I don't class it that way, but my agent was like, it would be better if we called the earlier ones like demos, but I don't know. I think if you asked me, I would say this is my seventh album because I'm 34 years old. Do you know what I mean? I've been doing this a long time. I don't want people to think that it's taken me 15 years to put out two records.
The ingenue, Grace Petrie, brand new.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Here she comes. With my debut. So like here I come with my like seventh album and it's not at all, it's not very political because that's not really what I was writing, you know what I mean? There's politics on it, but it's in a much more personal, it's from a more personal perspective of what I would regard as like the much more self-indulgent side of like, how do you keep going in terms of mental health and optimism and living in a world that is telling you every single day that you've already lost, you know, they're not barnstorming like, let's take the barricade songs like I was writing, you know, 15 years ago. And that does make me think like, what am I doing this for? What is the point of this? Do you know what I mean? And I think I never like claimed ever that I didn't want to be a musician. That was always what I wanted to be. And I always said that I was writing things that I was passionate about. And I was, obviously I am passionate about politics. I always will be passionate about politics. It's just at the moment that passion is, I'm passionately despair filled.
Yeah.
At the moment, I'm passionately despairing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to choose what message you want to be sending to people who like you and people who will find you as well, right? I feel like it's whatever's most present in your life at the time is what you're going to write songs about. That's how it is for me.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I don't think getting pigeonholed by yourself makes any sense. Like, no. I can only write songs about these things, otherwise I'm not being me.
Yeah.
Because a person is a myriad of things inside. We all have these vast inner lives, and some people might not, but I think most of us do.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, I think that idea that I have to be a protest singer and everything I have to say has to be really, really political. I think it, to be honest, like comes from a place of musical insecurity. I think that, you know, definitely when I was younger, particularly, I mean, we've spoken about this before, but like when I started playing on the folk scene, which is, you know, particularly in Britain, the folk music is like spectacularly technically proficient. And that is not the sort of musician I am. I'm like a three chord strummer, you know what I mean? And that's not, and I don't say that in a self-deprecating way. It's something I have taken me a long time to feel sort of like, that's fine. You know what I mean? There's room. We have an infinite bandwidth, and it's definitely okay for there still to be sort of like GCD songs in the world. We're never going to run out of them, you know, but I think, some of the earlier on when I sort of started playing on the folk scene, a lot of people would sort of say some variation of like, she's not much of a guitarist and she's not much of a singer, but what she's saying is really important, you know? And so that, I think it sort of left me with this hangover that I'm like, well, anything I'm saying has got to be really important, because if it's not, then I'm just not much of a guitarist and I'm not much of a singer. Like, what else is there, you know? And I think, I don't know, man. Like, I'm 34. I think I should just let myself off the hook for that and just be like, absolutely. Yeah. Like, you got to write what you got to write about. I think the word, I never want to be like disingenuously writing political songs and everyone be like scouring the headlines and being like, oh, I wonder what's going to go viral. Do you know what I mean? I'll try and fucking write something about that. That's like, I think that's that way lies madness, I think.
Yeah, I think that's what successful people do, but I'm not sure I want to be that kind of person either.
Yeah,
where
for
it's
sure.
so
for
calculated.
Sure. Yeah.
But so coming back to live stuff, how do you feel after this you know, enforced break? Because how important has live stuff been in terms of building your career over the past, let's say, 11 years?
100%, 100%. You know, it's not come through anything else really for me. You know, I think the only thing, and I've been very, 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 very lucky in that I was like able to support quite a few comedians who tour kind of throughout the year. So, you know, like for the past 10 years, I've been able to like tour. There's many years that I'd do like 6 or 7 tours of the UK in a year, you know, and just like keep crisscrossing. And they would always be new audiences because I, you know, that's the nature of, you know, supporting different people in different scenes. Like, so I was able to play to like loads of rooms of people who'd never seen me, even if I was coming back to a place that, you know, like I think 1 year, like I played Manchester with Robin Ince like 4 times, I think, in 1 year, you know, but yeah, it's still like loads of new people. So I think, yeah, I just gigged and gigged and gigged and gigged, you know, and mm-hmm. never really stopped that level. And that's, you know, the pandemic was a big shock to the system. Obviously it was for all mm-hmm. of us, but I mean, yeah, you know, I think in 2019 I did like 140 shows, and then it was like from that to like obviously immediate standstill and nothing and no way of knowing when it was going to end either.
Yeah. Yeah, because to me, from the outside, and I just see what, you know, online stuff, and whenever we bump into each other, we have a chat, but haven't bumped into anyone for a long time, yeah. So mostly online. But I just see, you seem to be someone who's very focused on making music and touring it. I don't see loads of stuff in between. I know you do stuff with the Guilty Feminist as well, but whereas I'm always, you know, fucking about with something else as well, you seem very focused, which I think is wonderful. I think I'd probably like to be a bit more like that, but I don't feel I can.
Oh, I feel like I'd like to be much more like you, actually.
Really?
And coming out of this, I think it's a craft, right? And you gotta hone it. And I think for years I sort of didn't, you know what I mean? Because I was gigging all the time, you know what I mean? And like, if I had, you know, a 2-week period with 13 gigs in it, and then I got offered one on the night off, I'd be like, great, it's the night off, I can do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I had a quite sort of like obsessive almost sense of like, well, that might be the one. Like that might, like it'll, yeah, that'll, yeah, always be that, you know, if I miss that gig, that'll be the one, you know? And I think, yeah, quality over quantity, I think is not a bad tenet to sort of try and build into the thing. And I think, you know, I'm sort of starting to be a bit more like, I've got like a kind of small like studio set up here in my house now that I kind of put together over the pandemic, and I'm learning like more of the production side of things very tentatively and like dipping my toe in the water there.
Yeah.
But you know, before I would never like work on a song at home, you know, like every time I've ever recorded, I've just kind of been like, cool, I'd like literally finish one, be like, yeah, that's 12, let's go in, let's get them down. Do you know what I mean? And like, whether they were good or not, you know, which is why there have been so many records over the years. I think again, like it just sort of comes from that vague sense of like, well, I've just got to be out all the time, got to be out all the time. And like, and you know, like if I've got a new album, like great, I can go out and flog that. And like, you know, the sort of sense of like scattergun approach. It's never been very strategic, I don't think. So it's funny, like that you, like, it's sort of nice that from the outside you'd regard that as focused, whereas I kind of regarded it as just like, I don't know, frenzied.
Well, we're all just making it up as we go along, aren't we?
Yeah. Absolutely.
My normal will be different to your normal, I guess. And then my perception of you will never be the same as your perception of you.
Sure.
So, of course. That's very interesting because, I think this enforced break, shall we say, hopefully has caused people to take a bit of stock and think about what they were doing. I think I was gigging too much before and it was quite scattergun, and I started to really dislike it. Because I never really had the feeling that you mentioned about, that this gig might be the one. I assumed it wouldn't be. I think I got to the point where I was like, well, and this won't be either, because that's not, to me, in my career, there hasn't been the one. There really hasn't. And it has been incredibly difficult to get onto bills that would be sort of, you know, have an audience who would get me or like be into the sort of thing I was into. So I found that really difficult. I was going to ask you about genres though, because you've mentioned protesting, you've mentioned folk, because it seems to me that your music can fit into lots of different kinds of categories And the only reason categories are important is to sort of get on bills that make sense or like find audiences that make sense for you. I think your music crosses those. But I also know that folk in the UK particularly can be very specific. And the people who, you know, are big in the folk scene in terms of audience members are very specific about what is folk and what isn't folk. Mm. So what's been your experience of that? Like, are you welcomed by folk, or do you, would you call yourself a protest singer? Like, what are you? What are you, Grace?
Yeah, what am I? No. It's probably unfair to say that I haven't been welcomed in folk.
Yeah.
I'm like horrifically oversensitive and horribly narcissistic. So if like 9 out of 10 people like me, I'll just be like, one person didn't like me. So like I sort of have this,
same here.
Yeah. So I have this like yeah. horrible fucking like victim narrative about the folk scene, which I don't think is probably, the folk scene does not deserve me going around telling people that the folk scene's been mean to me. But the folk scene, I would say is like, when I was a kid, I was listening to Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, and people referred to that as folk music.
Yeah.
And then I started playing an acoustic guitar and writing some political material. So I was like, I guess I'm a folk singer.
Right.
And then I was like, I'll try and get gigs at folk festivals. And I didn't really know very much about British folk music, English folk music. I didn't know anything about traditional music. And I was quite ignorant and I was quite arrogant. I did go into it with a bit of a chip on my shoulder, being a bit like, why won't I get booked at any of these folk festivals? And it's because I wasn't really doing folk as they saw it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was younger, I was a dickhead about that, you know, and I was like, I wrote a horrible, immature song about it, you know, and like, I know, horrific.
Which one's that? I want to listen.
It's called A Revolutionary in the Wrong Time, and it's got this like really mean-spirited line about how like, well, I'll never get booked for a folk festival because I can't grow a beard, which is just like such low-hanging fruit, you know what I mean? And just like pathetic, pathetic.
Did it help you get booked, by the way?
What do you think?
Those songs tend not to.
Yeah. But I think but I you know, now I look back and I just think, but I wouldn't try and get booked at a jazz festival. Do you know what I mean? And I wouldn't be like, it's so unfair this jazz festival hasn't booked me, like the way I used to feel about folk festivals. And I think that it's tough specifically with folk because it is like, it's a massively broad church, and you will get, you know, your Frank Turners at Cambridge Folk Festival, but then you'll also have like your Morris dancing at Shrewsbury Folk Festival. And like the idea that those two things are like supposed to be part of the same like genre, like is quite mad. Do you know what I mean? Like it's that like yeah. that's such a wide ranging spectrum.
They still won't let you in.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
What?
I know. But I think I kind of because I used to be part of a 6-piece collective called Coven, which was me and 5 other people. And those 5 people were much, much more folk, pure folk artists, you know. An incredible folk artist. And they all, like, both, it was a trio and a duo and me, and we sort of made this 6-piece band. And it was Lady Masry and Julian Tito, and those guys all, very rightly so, were like already incredibly respected in the folk scene, continue to be. So that was a bit of a foot in the door for me at a lot of those clubs and those festivals that previously kind of hadn't really had much time for me, but they were like, oh, here's a band with Julian Tito and Lady Masry, and it's also that girl, I guess we'll like, I guess, you know, we have to let her in. Yeah. But then I think, you know, by that stage, I think I had like written some more stuff that was a bit more folk influenced and like made a bit more sense in a folk context. And, you know, I think I sort of have the two different types of things in my catalogue, which is like, I do have the kind of like real strummy, strummy, shouty, shouty, quite sweary, like, you know, we'll fight them on the beaches, protest singing. And then I do have the kind of like softer element of things, I think does sort of belong better maybe in those contexts, those folk contexts.
Yeah.
But it's a tough thing. I find genres a really tough thing. I find it a really tough thing, you know, because I've always had this problem with like, as you know, like people when they're trying to sell music, or I guess when they're trying to sell art of any kind, you know, they'll be like, what's it like? Give me some other artists that you'll like. And like, the point is, we're all trying to be like no one else. We're all trying to do something new. You know what I mean? Like, obviously we're influenced by people, and like, we can say people that it's sort of like, and I sort of developed this style because I was doing so many gigs all the time, you know, because I sort of, when I was in my early 20s, I was like, I guess what I'm supposed to do is try and get a record deal, which is very funny.
I mean,
because
yes.
I'm still waiting on it.
You know how I feel about that shit.
Yeah. And then like, that was never going to be an option for me. Like I was just never going to be mm-hmm. a sort of in industry. I was never going to be what the industry are looking for. And so the other way I found was just like to just gig, take any gig that's offered. And I was offered just quite a strange, beautiful variety of gigs. So I got offered folk gigs, but I got offered punk gigs. And then I did get offered some comedy gigs as well. Mm. And because I'm always trying to please the people that I'm playing to, I would kind of adapt to whatever room I was in. So I did, I would never call it comedy, but I started writing some stuff that was like a little bit more lighthearted, a bit more comedic. Just so that if I did get offered a comedy gig, I wasn't totally out of my depth being on a bill with comics and going out and just doing something really angry and serious. Do you know what I mean? So I sort of started. Yeah. And then likewise, you know, when I was kind of started getting more folk gigs, you know, I wrote Queer as Folk, the album that came out in 2018, is quite a lot more like folk inspired, you know, and there's, I'd say that's probably the folkiest thing I've done. And that was just sort of reacting to like where I was going to be, where it was going to be the best received, you know what I mean? And that's not something that I would like recommend even, do you know what I mean? I think that sort of chameleon-esque sort of just adapting to whatever like room you're going to be put in. I don't know if it necessarily makes for the best art, which is why I think that like, again, it's been weird, the pandemic, obviously. It's been a very, very strange thing, and it's been like a whole reckoning in terms of my personal, as it has for us all, I'm sure, like in terms of mental health and stuff, like, you know, it's, I feel like I've been meeting my worst self in every corner of my house for like a year and a half. But I do think the record that I wrote largely and recorded in lockdown, you know, it couldn't really be a chameleon of a record because there was nobody else around, you know what I mean? So I guess we're going to find out what colour I am when I'm not trying to blend in with a tribe, I suppose.
Yeah. Do you listen back to any of that earlier work and think, I don't know who that is now?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. More of the love songs. I think I have a lot of regrets about the way that I, you know, we're all so good, aren't we, at writing songs that just paint us as the victim of everything and the like, or I'm very good at writing songs that paint us as like, you know, this kind of...
That's what my entire first two albums are. Pretty sure.
Same, you know what I mean?
That's directed at me.
Well, I just think there's this song on the new album called No Woman Ever Wants to Be a Muse. Mm. And it's kind of all about this idea that like, you know, we all of us have war stories from love and heartbreak, and we all remember it in this way where we did nothing wrong and they did everything wrong.
Well, I didn't though.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, apart from you who actually didn't. Yeah. And in lots of ways, you know, I was just like reacting to a patriarchal society that has always immersed me in this very specific mainstream depiction of what love supposedly is and how love supposedly is. Sorry, I'm forgetting that you're not putting out the video of this, but I'm putting quotation marks around the word love. But what, yeah, what that supposedly is like just the endless pursuit of somebody and persisting with somebody, whether or not they love you back or not. You know, I mean, I look at Friends now, you know, like the TV show Friends, and I think that was like my cultural landscape growing up, you know, like the most romantic thing that my generation believed in was this idea of this guy who just never gives up on his ex-girlfriend for like 10 years until eventually what happens is he wears her down, basically. You know, there's a lot of early songs, like there's a song on the first album called Incompetent Love Song, and it's like 6 minutes of me listing all of the ways that I'm not good enough for this person. And the amount of people that have come up to me over the years and say like, oh, that's like mine and my partner's song. And I think, get out of the relationship. Like, you know, oh like, God. Honestly, it's like, and I think like that 6 minutes of me like apologizing for who I am. Mm. And also at the same time, in this weird narcissistic way, sort of making the audience think that I'm this little self-effacing little, you know, self-deprecating little cool guy who actually underneath it is just so romantic and reliable and believable. Right. And like, listen, I gave as good as I got in that relationship. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think, yeah. You know, that wherever she is now, she could write some dreadful songs about me as well, and thank God she didn't, to my knowledge. But but I think, yeah, a lot of that early stuff, I think, I mean, it's tough, isn't it, because we're all growing all the time, and we're like, you know, like we use songwriting as a way to expel what's happening inside us, and like, and it's and it's therapy, and it's catharsis, and that's you know, I think that's important. You know, it was important for me. It was important that I wrote all that stuff. But now I'm a grown up, and I want to talk to that 21-year-old kid who wrote that song and be like, first of all, that's not love. That's obsession anyway. Yeah. You know what I mean? First of all.
Yeah.
And second of all, like, it's, you don't, you know, like, you don't have to play this game that, like, mainstream patriarchal society has always told you that there's like one way to express love, and like what that means is like utter self-sacrifice forever in total martyrdom and making yourself, prostrating yourself, and like not putting your needs first, and that's romance, baby. And I think that's all bullshit now, do you know what I mean? And I feel like I was conned, and then I feel like I became a tool of the patriarchy to sort of like then repeat that con in my music and put it out there, you know, and be like, isn't this great? Isn't this love? So those are the things that I regret much more than all. I mean, my politics haven't really changed broadly. I mean, I've kind of gone sort of ping-ponged between Labour and the Green Party in various records over the years. But I think the general tenets of that stuff, I like to think I'm learning still about politics all the time, you know, but I definitely think the love stuff, you know, it's a cruel irony, isn't it, that like you'll never feel anything as intensely as you do when you're like, you know, 17, 18, 19. And I think if you could bottle those feelings, the intensity of those feelings, you'll never feel, sorry to anybody older than that listening to this, but like, spoiler alert, you'll never feel anything as intensely as you do at that age. But like, good, you know, I'm too fucking tired. Yes. I'm too tired to live like that all the time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, the love stuff is interesting, isn't it? Because I asked that question because I look back at my stuff. I haven't got to the point where I want to delete anything from the catalogue of life, you know? It's not like I'm so embarrassed by myself 10 years ago that I want to remove those songs from existence or anything.
Mm.
But I do find it kind of interesting to go, oh yeah, I was sort of writing about, it kind of centered around, this person's been so terrible to me. But then when I look at it now, I just think, no, they just knew that we weren't right together and they called it at the right time.
Yeah.
And really the thing I think I learned eventually, I hopefully have now learned, no, I'm now married, so like this would be awful. If I haven't learned and I'm just hanging on to this thing, that this dead relationship, he's going to listen and be like, I thought we were okay. But I think I've learned to call it earlier now.
Yeah.
When a relationship isn't working out. Mm. You know, there were ones, it's not the other person's fault at all, really. Like if you have an inkling that it's not the right thing and you feel like you're just trying to make it work for 4.5 years after the 6 month sort of honeymoon period is over, they just weren't right for you.
Yeah, totally.
And there's this wonderful article I share with friends who are thinking about leaving their partners, right? Which is called Fuck Yes or No. It's by Mark Manson, who's this wonderful writer. And it's essentially that if it's not a fuck yes, it's a no.
Yeah.
And that can apply to anything.
Yeah.
If you're not fully into something, it's a no.
Yeah.
Obviously, if there's a job, you might need to keep doing the job because you need the money. It's not quite so simple. Please don't go and quit everything and dump everyone and blame me, please. But that I really love that idea. And instead of agonizing for literally years over, should I be with this person or not? I've learned now that the agonizing thing means no.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not working. Absolutely. It's not working out.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying everything needs to be easy. Mm. Sometimes you're going to have hard times, obviously, but not that hard, not that early on.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of my songs are kind of that kind of thing. So there's a song called Delete, which is about wanting to not have to make a decision in this relationship, which I think I wrote 6 months before I finally did break that one off.
Yeah.
And it just seems so crass now because, you know, I don't think we shouldn't be writing songs about real things. I think that's what they're for. Mm. Like you say, it's therapy and it's working through stuff. It's figuring out who you are, where you are, all that. And to be honest, again, like if that person wants to make some shitty art about me, or not shitty art, if they want to make some art being shitty about me, that's absolutely fine. That's their right.
Yeah.
And it's my right to tell my stories.
It's funny because our stories change.
Yeah.
I always say, like, we're going to be growing until the day we die. We're growing up all the time. Like, there's never going to be a day in my life that I feel like I'm cooked, you know, until it's over. But it's tough because, like, what we're doing all the time is recording our journey, you know, and like, so it's like logbooks, it's like field recordings from the road, you know, and like, you know, then you have this literal like record, but a record of like where you were and who you're in love with and how you felt and what you thought about yourself. And you know, I don't know, I just feel like it's my whole back catalogue is like, listen to them now. It's like, kid, get some therapy, go to therapy. It's all gonna be okay, but you need to go to therapy.
But then would the songs have suffered for that, because you just would have been fine?
I guess yeah. But then that's also a thing, because I feel like that's also like, they really want us to believe in like the tortured nature of art. Do you know what I mean?
And like, I know, and I'm not into that actually.
No, and I think particularly like in my, like I was talking about that song that I wrote in my early 20s, like I know that like I stayed in that relationship longer because I was like, you know, this horrible, tempestuous, one day it's fireworks, the next day it's like, you know, the best day ever. The next day is a massive stormy row. It's like screaming at each other in the street at 3 o'clock in the morning. I knew I was like writing loads about it. I was like this, you know, like, and I've ashamed now that I was like, she's just such a muse, you know, she's such a muse for me. Like, and it's just like so gross, you know, it's so gross. And, and like, I think I'm personally happier than I've ever been in my life. And I'm in an incredibly fulfilling relationship. And I think I'm writing, you know, I like the songs that I'm writing at the moment, and I think it hasn't, my ability to write songs didn't desert me the moment I got with somebody who was, you know, good for my self-esteem.
Same here. And this wonderful man that I'm with, I don't write songs about him because he hasn't done awful
fucked
things
you over.
To me. That's what I'm probably quite. I was going to say that, and I don't know why I didn't. But he hasn't as yet. Touch wood. But then I still managed to write two albums worth of stuff I'm really proud of. So Brace for Impact, and then the last album, Exotic Monsters.
Yeah.
And none of those are about sad current relationship or awfulness. Mm. It was about, you know, stuff I hadn't dealt with from before.
Yeah.
Which was very useful and cathartic and good therapy and stuff. And just stuff that was a bit more kind of, I wouldn't say not navel-gazing, because I don't think navel-gazing is bad. I think if we say navel-gazing is bad, that means you can't look at yourself and like figure stuff out. But that is what songwriting is for me. But I was able to lift my eyes up just a little bit and sort of have thoughts about the wider world. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was like, that's just surely just maturing as a person and songwriter at the same time.
Yeah.
So I felt that. So I was really excited to read about, so you did a really good in-depth interview with Get In Your Ears, wasn't it? Mm. About this thing about connectivity and it being maybe something a bit like that for you.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, the wider message of the album, I suppose, is like, yeah, just that we need connection. Human beings need connection, and I think it was what was so mad about the pandemic was like, is so mad. I know I talk about it in the past tense, but I suppose what I talk about in the past tense is like the extreme lockdown. You know, I know some places in the world are still in lockdown, but and I think it was like a mad juxtaposition of we're literally globally all going through the same thing, which has never been the case in my lifetime, in our lifetimes, or probably I suppose since the Second World War. You know, has there ever been a thing that was so globally that everyone in the world was touched by? But the thing that was connecting us was the thing that was separating us, and we were literally more separate than we've ever been as well. And it was this thing of like going through this thing separately but together in this way that everybody sort of feels the same way, but nobody really can connect those feelings to each other. And I found that was a very sort of I think a lot of it is definitely looking inside. I think that album, a lot of it is and I think I think of it more maybe because I'm used to writing such sort of specific political things. You know what I mean? Like, I think in the past I've definitely written things that have like aged very, very quickly, because it's not just a song about politics. It's like a song about this particular schism in this particular part of the Labour Party circa 2014 to 2015. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and that stuff is like over so quickly. So like, even though I suppose I am writing about things that are, I'd like to think, quite universal, they feel like they're kind of not, like, they feel like they're so personal because they're not specifically talking about Keir Starmer or, you know, Boris Johnson or Dominic Raab or whatever, which in a way I think I would have done earlier on in my career. I would have been much more, I used to just be so plugged into like the news and, you know, yeah, just writing in that really immediate way, like writing about specific, specific events and specific news stories. And I think I sort of I think I kind of can't write that way anymore, because I can't really be, at the moment anyway, I feel like I and this is obviously a very privileged thing to say, this is a privileged position to be able to take, but I feel like I can't really be engaged in political news in the way that I was, you know, earlier points in my life, because I was just finding that it was just really having an impact on me. You know, I felt very, particularly, you know, we came out of the 2019 election virtually straight into the pandemic. You know, there's only kind of 3 months between losing the election in this really catastrophic way after, you know, what felt like sort of 5 years of embattlement, really, you know, for people who were sort of on, you know, on the kind of left of the Labour Party. It was just sort of like 5 years of like kind of constantly battered, and then feeling like it was, you know, kind of lost in this really cataclysmic way that felt, you know, certainly like initially felt like it was impossible to ever come back from it. You know, I'm just not sure if I feel like that anymore, maybe in such a pessimistic way. But I think
it was natural to feel like that then. It's such a huge loss and so much hope. I mean, I even allowed myself to hope that time.
I
tend not to. I tend not to go there too much, because it's just so upsetting, like to feel so underrepresented in your own country.
It's
horrible. So when you're actually, like you, really super involved in it, and then it doesn't work, that's a loss. That's like a, it's not like a death, but there's, I think there's a level of like a loss.
It felt like a bereavement to me. Right, you know, okay. And I acknowledge, obviously, like I keep saying, this is a very privileged thing. I've lived a very, very, very privileged life. You know, I have a lot of privilege in the world, and I haven't, you know, had very many difficult things happen to me. And that was, that period immediately after the election was sort of one of the worst things that's ever, like, not that it happened to me, but it happened to us.
Yeah.
It happened to, you know, a movement of people who I think are going to be demonstrably hurt by the decisions of this government that could have been avoided. You know what I mean? And I think caring about that, anybody, you know, I don't know anybody who wasn't devastated about it. Yeah. And I think that's difficult, because, you know, everybody goes on about the echo chambers that we're all in because of social media. And I think there's definitely, obviously, that massively came into play with me. You know, I think I had a disproportionate amount of hope for the outcome of the election, because I was only spending time with people who really kind of wanted the same things as me. And I was only, you know, I was campaigning for the month before, and so I was only hanging out with Labour Party volunteers and councillors and, you know, people organising benefits, and like, I wasn't getting any negativity from them. Do you know what I mean? So I was, you know, I think a lot of us were quite unprepared. You know, the people who were the most in the thick of it, I think it was the biggest sort of shock to.
And it's hard to tell online for so many reasons, but partly because the negativity does tend to be much louder than the positivity, or can be. Depends who you follow, obviously.
Yeah.
But so you can get this sense that, oh, it's okay, that's just a loud bunch of people. It's actually not very many people. This is going to be fine, because, you know, in your offline world, you're talking to people in real life about this stuff, and it seems really positive.
Yeah, and it's completely distorting with so many issues, you know, you see it at the moment with like vaccine misinformation, you know, and that's the way that is just spreading like fucking wildfire across Facebook, completely unregulated and completely unmoderated. And it's so mad that like the internet, I owe basically my entire career to the internet. I would not have been able to be a musician if I'd have been born 30 years before I was. But it is crazy to me that we live in the time of the most unprecedented access to information that there's ever been, you know, like at any point, you know, the majority of the world can access kind of, you know, information at a whim. And we seem to know less than ever, you know what I mean? You would think that the logical conclusion of that would be that like, well, yeah, we'll know the truth of things, won't we? Like once the facts are out there and everyone can access them at any one time, like then the truth will be out there. And that just doesn't seem to be at all the case. You know, it feels like you can just choose your own truth on the internet, and people are. And as a result, we're just becoming so polarized on so many different things. And again, and you're right, you're right that it's completely impossible as well to tell how prevalent is this opinion that I'm seeing everywhere all the time. Do you know what I mean? I just don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of have this lovely lefty bubble going on my Twitter that, you know, if you believe, you know, if I never walked outside my house or looked at the front of a newspaper, then I would assume that like Black Lives Matter is like not contentious at all, and everybody completely agrees with it, and everybody absolutely, you know, is working for an anti-racist society. And you know, I believe that, you know, there's no transphobia and there's no homophobia, and that's, you know, obviously we know that isn't the way things are. So it's a strange time, I think, and it was a strange time to be sort of plunged from this like all-consuming grief about our political losses into then like, and now you're on your own in your house for a year and a half to think about it.
And you had to cut short an Australian tour.
Yeah.
That must have sucked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was, obviously it sucked. It was mad to be, I'd never been to Australia before. And, because you're on the opposite side of the clock. So I wasn't really in touch with anyone. Because when I was up, everyone in the UK was in bed and vice versa. So, you know, I was over there with my fiddle player, Ben Moss. And we were like, and it wasn't, it hit Britain worse, COVID, before it hit. Like Australia was a bit behind. So we were sort of seeing it, it was like a horror film. We were sort of seeing it develop in people's consciousness. On social media of our friends and stuff, you know, we'd wake up in the morning and, you know, scroll through like, you know, people's sort of tweets from the day before as it was. But it felt like a very like foreign concept because no one in Australia was kind of that bothered about it. And I remember like, I remember us having this weird sense of like, God, it really feels like people in Britain are really losing their marbles about COVID, you know. And then obviously, before I think within 24 hours of us having that conversation, it sort of hit in a big way in Australia. And then our festival's cancelled. And then, you know, we were due to fly home on the Tuesday. The festival's cancelled on the Friday. And so we were planning then to just hang out in Sydney, you know, and just get our flight home. And then over the course of that Friday, it all started to look quite a lot more serious. And I think by about 3 o'clock, we kind of looked at each other and said, do you think we should actually just move the flights? Do you think we should just get home actually? And so we moved them up to the Saturday. And I think if we hadn't, and within 20, it was that day that we flew out that Australia had started grounding flights. So I think if we'd have waited, we wouldn't have got home, you know, because we flew back on like the 13th of March or something. So it was pretty, it was like right. It was like, it was within days, within three days of lockdown, I think. So it was mad.
So we're thinking back to that. I think that was the day that I went to, it might have been that day that I drove to see Frank Turner play, and I interviewed him for this
show. Oh, cool.
Show. Yeah. He was one of the really early guests. He was the last in-person guest I had.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I don't pay that much attention to the news because I find it really, really detrimental to my mental health. So I don't think 24-hour news is good for anyone.
Neither do I. Fully agree.
It's just dreadful. So I'd only picked up a few bits about it, and people were talking about washing their hands. And I remember feeling like, don't you already wash your hands, you gross person? My hands are always clean. But obviously I didn't know like what they were really talking about. And then we were driving to the gig and the motorway on a Saturday afternoon was really empty. Mm. And that's when we knew, oh, this is an actual thing. Yeah. Saw the gig. It was in Aylesbury. That's where it was. Huh. Drove back the next day and saw like empty supermarket shelves. Mm. And then we were like, oh, okay, this is a real thing.
Yeah.
And again, what a privileged position to be in, to sort of like wake from this sort of little hermitude sleep going, oh, okay, something bad's happening. But it's one of those things, isn't it? That just, you know, those sorts of things don't tend to come to the UK. How lucky are we, you know, SARS, etc. Like they don't tend to come here.
And I think with what you're saying about 24-hour news, like I think, you know, For my whole life, for as long as I can remember, you know, the Daily Mail and the Telegraph and the Times have just been screaming at me about something that's going to get me. You know what I mean? Something's coming, something, and it's, you know, like it's gangs or it's, you know, and they kind of operate at this constant fever pitch of threat. You know what I mean? And I do, I'm like, on, you know, honestly, I did think initially I was like, I bet this doesn't come to anything. You know, I bet this is just going to be another one of those things that doesn't really come to anything. And, you know, that's that aged like a fine milk, that attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. Weird times, basically.
Yeah, very.
But it's good you were able to make music during it because I think a lot of people, I get the impression that a lot of people put things on hold. Like they put releases on hold, they stop doing things, just waiting for it to be over. And I do remember those early days when, I remember when there was the thing of if you're in a vulnerable category or you're over a certain age, you need to stay home for 12 weeks. And that seemed like, oh my God, that's so long to stay home.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And now it's like, when there's that never-ending lockdown towards the end of last year, where we're all losing our marbles. Mm. Like 12 weeks would have been a dream.
Absolutely.
But just to be able to keep creating. And I know this is a difficult subject for some people because some people have felt very uninspired. That's fine. Mm. My existence is not a judgment on the way you choose to do things. I was able to create music during that time. Mm. You were able to create music during that time. That's just what happened.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm really glad because I love it when more Grace Petrie music comes into the world. So I'm really pleased to hear that.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, I mean, I did. I totally sympathise with people who struggled. And I think at first I found myself like very, very, you know, like I said, I've always just been gigging as hard as I can since I was sort of 20. And at first I found the expanse of time very intimidating. And, you know, and just the idea that people would be saying, well, like, you must be writing loads. You must be writing loads. You must be doing, like, people going, oh, I'm going to have time to write a book. I'm going to have time to. And I did. And I, you know, for the first month we did, Ben, so poor old Ben, my fiddle player, he came home with me and he was staying in my house for a few days. And then, of course, because he was sort of between places, he was house hunting at the time. And then they just made it illegal for him to leave. So he was stuck here for 6 months, completely unplanned. I think within the first couple of days of lockdown, I said, let's just do a cover. Let's post a cover song. And so we came up with this idea to do like an alphabet of cover songs. And we like, you know, started with, you know, A and like went through to Z, like the song name started with letters of the alphabet. And initially that was like the only thing I could do, you know, and that obviously took a month. And for the first month, that's all I was doing really, was just arranging these covers. And there were days that I was like, this is the only thing I'm getting out of bed for. You know what I mean? It's the only thing I'm getting dressed to do. But it was nice because it was like, you know, there's precious few silver linings, of course, about the last 18 months. And I'm aware that I just massively slagged it off. But I think if we hadn't have had the internet, I think it would have been, can you imagine how horrendous that would have been? You know, I mean, I think the fact that we were able to connect in all manner of ways, you know, and I think there was, you know, like obviously like now, you know, I've seen a lot of people say like, oh, yeah, like it sure beats a live stream, like, you know, when they're in front of an audience. And I think, you know, fair enough, but like, I would have died without live streams. I would have died without Facebook Live. I would have died without social media. You know, like I needed to know there was somebody out there, you know, like, and it didn't matter how many people it was. Yeah. And I think, you know, we were doing these silly, and they were mostly like silly pop songs. We're doing these pop covers and we would just post them on Instagram every day. And as the thing, as it went on, you know, it got a bit momentum. And there were times that, you know, I got like a couple of really, really nice messages from, I remember like a nurse sent me a message saying like, I just got in at 4 o'clock in the morning from like the most horrifically traumatic shift. And like, I just did watch this video of like Sound of the Underground and it feels like the first time I've smiled in days and days. And like, yeah. You know, to be able to like, as at a time that I felt so completely and utterly useless, and I felt like I've chosen this incredibly non-essential bourgeois career, you know, that like can't possibly be any help to anybody. It was, you know, at least to feel like, well, if there's one person in this incredibly troubled world that I can make smile today, then like that has to be worth something, you know. And like, how would we have got through it without, you know, the ability to commune in that way? You know, I remember that one of the times that we did one of the live stream gigs we did on Facebook Live, and I remember one of my favorite moments of the night was like at the start, and you see people like log in on the comments, and one of the first comments was this guy, like, just he just logged in and said, evening everyone, or anything from the bar, and like just as a joke. But it was really like, and it was like, and yeah. Ben was the only person I'd seen in months and months, and I was the only person he'd seen in months and months. And I remember, like, both of us, it was so mad how we could come out of it feeling the gig adrenaline and feeling like as if, well, there were all these people here tonight. And of course they weren't, but they were, you know? And but they were, yeah.
That's the thing. They were. Those things are completely legitimate. I've been doing online shows since 2013 because I knew that there's so many people who might like my music or already did would never be able to come and see me play because, you know, so many reasons, geography, children, money, whatever. So I wanted to make it more accessible. So I was really delighted to see that the rest of the world realized that you could do online gigs last year.
Yeah.
But then I really don't like it when people kind of dismiss them as not real gigs or virtual. It's not virtual. Mm. It's actually happening. Yeah. Like, I actually am playing and you actually are listening in real time. Mm. I know that word is sort of overused and used badly. But there's something very beautiful about that. And I think that that time certainly shows the relationship between a performer and a, you know, artist and audience in that collaboration, that giving and taking, but both giving and both taking. Because I got so much from being connected to people, and they tell me they got so much from being connected to me in the various ways. And I have a big problem with, you know, the internet and social media taking up too much of my time and focus and making me feel shit a lot. But last year made me think, well, but it's so wonderful, though. It can be so wonderful and it is so powerful. Yeah. So it's just not a simple thing to dismiss.
It's not.
You can't just go, we shouldn't be on Facebook.
Yeah.
Because like there's value to it for everybody too.
I completely agree. And I, like, coming out of this, like, I'm definitely going to keep doing live streams for exactly the reasons that you say, you know. And I realize, you know, there were so many people saying to me, like, I've never been able to come see you before because of XYZ. And like, now I can. And how shit that it took a pandemic for me to like consider those people. Do you know what I mean? And consider that was something that I could offer using the internet.
But you were always out, to be fair.
Sure. But I totally agree. And I think that, you know, I need social media for my job. I need social media for my career. Obviously we all do.
Yeah.
I also, you know, I'm old enough to recognize that like I need to feel connected to people. I need that interaction. I enjoy the engagement from people online and I get self-esteem from it. And I think that it gets people to come to my shows and it gets people to listen to my music. And it is often very harmful to my mental health. Both things can be and frequently are true. And, you know, I think it's like, I know it's quite sort of in vogue at the minute for like people to be sort of, when we're talking about musicians' mental health and stuff, it's quite in vogue for people to be like, yeah, you know, get offline and don't. It's like, it's not that simple. Do you know what I mean? Like ever been, you know, like for independent artists like us, like there's only ever been online. And like, and also there's a part of me that sort of feels like, you know, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best. You know what I mean? I sort of think like this is, it's the real thing. You know what I mean? And I think it's, There were definitely times in the pandemic that I was like just on Twitter all day and like probably in a way that wasn't useful to me. But at the same time, I felt like my community was out there and they were holding me and they were holding space for me and they were making me feel like they were going to catch me, you know what I mean? When there wasn't anybody in the real flesh and blood world who could. And I'm grateful to them and I'm grateful for the feeling that I could offer the same thing to anybody else in the world. You know, I think it's a complicated beast, the internet.
It is, yeah. Because it's incredibly disingenuous to just post positive things.
Yeah, I'm sure the printing press caused this much of a stir when, you know, when they first came up with that. I'm sure they were like, this is going to ruin the world. You know what I mean? And like, I think it's just a tool, like all things. It can be used for good. It can be used for bad. And we've all obviously we've experienced both.
Yeah. I think it's incredibly disingenuous to only post positive things. But I also find it hard sometimes to be, like, I'm not completely honest on Twitter. Like, when I get really fucked off about something, I don't really tend to go there because I don't want to just use it. Because it's the easiest one to post something quick on. That's not like a big palaver. Like, if I do a Facebook post on my pen friend page, it feels like I am making an announcement. Whereas on Twitter, it just feels like this thing has really annoyed me. It's just easier to sort of chat on there. But I don't want to always turn to it for negativity, which it because of the medium, it sort of inspires that, clearly, if you look at what people post on there. But then, I think showing, just being honest is really important. I got a bit narky with someone on Facebook on the weekend and it's sort of playing around in my head a bit because I think people's intentions, especially if they're visiting your page on the internet, are generally good. It's not like a drive-by random person just negging you for no reason. But I think also, only very recently I've been establishing some boundaries of like, no, it's not acceptable to send me an email that contains that. And I will block you. I will remove you from my mailing list. I'll block you on all the platforms because I just don't need to see that. It's not about only accepting compliments. It's just about going, I'm a person with feelings and that's not okay. It's not cool that I have to open my email and read that from you. And then likewise on Facebook, some people saying some stuff and just like, what? I'm an actual person here. Like, what are you saying that for? I find that to be annoying. It's worse when it's someone who's supposedly a fan / supporter or whatever. Much worse because I just expect it from random strangers who don't know my stuff yet. So it is complicated, but I'm glad you're getting good things from it. It's not generally bad for you. It doesn't seem to be generally bad.
It's not generally bad. And I think, you know, to that end, I completely agree. And I've had some people, sometimes it's like the worst things from the people who supposedly are like, you know, because I think it does engender that familiarity. You know, a lot of people think they think that we're friends. They think that they're pals.
Yeah.
And so they can say like, you look a bit fat in this outfit, lol. And it's like,
oh my, what?
Like, in what universe? In universe? Do you know what I mean? Like, how has this happened that this person that I don't even know, who's sitting in Stoke-on-Trent or something, has written this to me on the internet and like sort of, you know, kind of low-key ruined my day. But like, but I think that, you know, also, and I found this like kind of observing Frank's like, because there's a lot of people.
Dog or Turner?
Oh, Turner. But I know, yeah. You'd be amazed how often I have to make that clarification in my life. And like some of the stuff that he gets, you know, it's like, it's...
it's ridiculous.
There are people who make a fucking sport out of it, out of hating him and not hating him. I mean, because I don't think they actually do hate him. I think that's the point. I think they don't think about... And it's exactly what you say that I think, you know, any one of us... who performs under a name, you know, if it's your own name, if it's Pen Friend, if it's Frank Turner, if it's Grace Petrie, it's like, as soon as you have the page that's like artist page, in some people's minds, and I've seen this happen, it's this disconnect as if you become an entity, not a person. You're not a human being, do you know what I mean? And it's like, there's only ever one person reading these notifications and it's the person they're talking to, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think that, I was guilty of that before I knew Frank. I thought he was I didn't have any negative opinions on him, but I thought he was like, he's huge. There's no way he's seeing his social media engagement. And then I met him as a person. I was like, he's a real person. He's a real person reading this. Like, that's happening to him the way that it happens to me. Do you know what I mean? Like, on a much larger level, but like, and I think that thing, you know, there's, I've sort of stopped doing it now because you kind of never get anywhere with anyone. But I, you know, I did go through a phase of saying to people when they would like troll me or whatever, I did go through a phase of just saying, do you know there's a person here? Do you know that there's no manager reading this? There's no one shielding me from this. Mm. Do you know that this is the same thing as like ringing my doorbell and saying that to my face? Do you know that's essentially what you're doing?
Yeah.
And would you ring my doorbell and say that to my face? Do you need to say this today? Do you need, you know, like this is particularly like random people commenting on like sponsored Facebook ads of my tour or whatever.
Oh, they're the worst,
you know, and it's just, and it's just always like, and I'm sorry, but it is always men. It's just always men who like, who.
I'm sorry that it is too, but it is always.
I'm sorry that it is too, but, it, and it's like, it's okay to just let things pass by your chops. It's okay. You don't know, your input isn't needed on everything, you know, and like, and you might write something funny about how shit I am or how shit I look or whatever and like never think about it again. But I've got that now. Like I've, that's happened. That's come right to my phone.
It's going around and around.
A bell has rung on my phone that's gone, look at your phone. Someone said something to you and I've opened it and that's what it's been. And it's so mad to me that it's like how, and I honestly don't think Joe idiot on Facebook who's done that. I don't think they complete the thought to that conclusion. I don't think there's any part of it. They're just like, they're like all the rest of us. They're just stupid animals looking for dopamine. That's the only reason any of us are on social media, of course. And they've said that to get a few likes, to get a few whatever. And I think the that's where, you know, there's just a lot of people who are using those things without any sense of empathy in the truest sense of the word. Any sense of like, this is a fellow human being who's going to read this about themselves.
Yeah.
But it's so in the minority, you know, like it's so in the minority and, you know, people are overwhelmingly use the internet to be gorgeous, you know, like to, they go out of their way to say things that mean very much to me, you know. But like I said, I am the sort of person, we're all the sort of person, this is not something specific to me, but we're all the sort of person who remembers the one person out of 10 that didn't like us. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
I'm sure you're the same, that like off the top of my head, I could recall to you, you know, the 10 meanest things anyone has ever said about my music.
Oh, they're all going around my head right now. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
It's like that they're at the top of the filing cabinet all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
People love to say, oh, don't read the comments. Oh, don't respond. Don't feed the trolls and all this. But one, I don't think they are trolls. I think they're people.
Mm.
And I think everybody has value.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some people are mean and some people are evil, but some people are just really mean and casually cruel and things.
Mm.
And I'm not going to get into a long drawn out debate with people, but I'll always give people the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim, my husband, really hates it when we do a Facebook ad and there's just, it's random people. And really, once you're reaching outside your bubble, you're going to get casually cruel comments. You just are. It just means that the ad's working.
Absolutely.
And that's what we want, isn't it? What's the point of doing them otherwise? So, he does actually shield me from the worst ones. But I always would prefer to respond to someone just to go, hi, I'm a human. You are too. Mm. You said something you thought was important. I might just sort of acknowledge it or sort of, you know, maybe stand up for myself if appropriate. Mm-hmm. Like someone had a go at me for wearing, what's all that mess on our lips? And then some sick face.
Because
I had some lipstick on.
Oh, fuck off.
Well, quite.
Yeah.
And that's one I'm not going to leave because it's absolutely my right to wear whatever the fuck I like on my face. And it's not okay for him to tell me what to do about that. So I did respond to that one. Someone just did a drive-by tattooed slut. Was a good one.
Wow.
But like no comment on the music. He just doesn't like women existing, I think.
Mm.
So that's a different matter. Mm. You know, that's definitely his problem.
Tattoos.
That's one that we would just remove, you know.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Fine.
Yeah.
But you know, all of this, and it doesn't personally hurt me. What personally hurts me is when someone who's supposedly a fan or supporter starts telling me what I should and shouldn't do.
Yeah.
I just think, you don't know me but at all.
Mm.
Like, what do you think is going to happen here? And that's when I will stand up for myself because I'm a 40-year-old woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do what I like.
Yeah.
And surely that's why you're following me in the first place. I would hope that some of that independent spirit would be why.
Yes, so of course.
I find that to be irritating. And it's just a bit deflating because I'm just trying to do nice things and put things that are positive into the world. And then to sort of have to deal with that is just a bit annoying. But like you say, overwhelmingly, people are awesome. And it's wonderful to be connected to them online. And, you know, they give us both a living,
yeah,
you know,
definitely.
From the things that we make. I'm incredibly thankful for that. Mm-hmm. But that's not without its problems. But no job is.
It's not without its problems. And I think, you know, both of us, like, I think I obviously have that gratitude to the grassroots engagement. And like, you know, as you say, where would we be without it? But I do think, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world. I love being DIY. I'm sure that at this point I will always be DIY. And actually, if I had a choice at this point, I would always be DIY. But I think you're more open to it. Because you're more accessible. We have to be more accessible. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I'm sure there are label bands and artists who are sort of like, you know, aren't dealing with their own kind of social media engagement and aren't like facing that sort of thing. But I think it's, you take the rough with the smooth. People, we have a genuine engagement with our audiences, which we need to have. I know that I need to have for my own self as well, not just in terms of like, I wouldn't have a job without it, but like, I like to feel, and I think you, I know you like to feel like I'm connected to these people, you know, we're having a communion here. We're sharing something, like this is a conversation between, you know, like I might be the one on the stage, but like, this is a conversation that we're having. And that's important to me, you know, and that always will be important to me. And it's just a shame that it means you let the bad in with the good, I suppose. But yeah.
I suppose there's always going to be some fuckwit talking at the bar, isn't there?
There always will be. There always will be. Yeah.
How's that been? I know we're talking for a long time. I will wrap this up soon. But
oh, no, I'm loving it. But
have people been chatting at gigs as much as they did before the pandemic, in your experience?
Well, I've only done like... five or so, which have all been quite completely disparate and mad and weird. Like, one was outdoors and it was in Nottingham and it was like socially distanced outdoors. And like, honestly, no offense to the people who came, and obviously no offense to Nottingham Arboretum, but I found that quite hard, just quite a bad time, just because everyone was so spread out and it was very hard to sort of like get any kind of atmosphere going, I suppose. The ones that I have done that have been indoors, like, it's a difficult thing because I know that, and I completely, of course, respect that not everybody feels comfortable to attend gigs yet. And some might not, they might not return to that, you know what I mean? Like, it's not as though we have an end point in sight for all of this. I think that, the ones who have come back are the people who really, really, really need live music. You know, the ones who really missed it from their lives.
Yeah.
And they are so joyous to be there, you know. And I've just found them like so engaged and like, yeah. So I think less talking in terms of like the randos who've kind of come in and like, you know, they were dragged along by mates, or like they, you know, they were drinking there anyway and then a gig started and somebody forgot to kick them out or whatever. Like, that it just kind of isn't happening, you know. Like, it's the people who are like the most dedicated folks are there. People are still wanting to come up and talk and have a chat, and it's difficult at the end of the show because like I'm such a like huggy bear, you know, and I'm such a like, let's jump in and have a photo and let's have a hug and like, let's tell each other our coming out stories and let's, you know, do all of that.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a tough one. I'm heading out on tour next week and like having conversations with my agents, like, you do know you're not going to be able to do all that. And I'm a bit like, you do know I'm not going to be able to not really do that. That's not like, that's kind of how I work. It's a difficult thing. I guess people have got to do what they're comfortable with, you know?
Yeah. And it's also about tours being able to continue to completion, isn't it? So I know, especially in America, the people have been really super strict on like everyone on the crew, you know, big tours I'm talking about, like everyone has to have double vaccines and all this stuff. Like, they just have to, because there's just so much at stake in terms of money, venues, all of that, insurance, whatever. Mm-hmm. As much as anyone needs to get through the tour and be able to sing every night, even in pre-pandemic times. So like shouting at the bar till 2 a.m, you know, talking to people isn't something that everyone can do because they need to sing the next night. I think it's a similar thing. Like, you need to stay well to do your whole tour, to show up for those commitments you've made to all those people, not just the first three nights or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's hard, isn't it? Because that that stuff is so much part of the gig, isn't it? Especially for you. I feel the same.
So much for me. So much. Yeah. And I think, and I had this actually kind of, I sort of learned my lesson immediately pre-pandemic, because the last tour I did was in the autumn of 2019. And I lost my voice. And I lost my voice because I was talking to people, you know, like I was sort of doing, it's like doing merch in between in the interval and then at the end, and like chatting. And I enjoy talking to people, you know, and it's part of the, and also like, you know, I was touring on my own then. And I mean, Ben's actually coming with me to play with me on this tour, which will be really nice. But most of my 20s, you know, I've been touring on my own, and it's like, yeah, I'm on my own like 20 hours of the day. Like, and then, you know, it's nice to have some company. Like, I'm going to talk to people. Do you know what I mean? But I lost my voice through chatting, not singing. So I, again, I'm like just trying to be a bit disciplined about that these days, you know. Yeah. But, you know, it's a shame. It's a shame to, because that's the most important part of it for me. You know, I think it's, and it goes back to what your kind of opening question about what you're doing it for. Like, I think it's very easy for me to sort of think the only worth in what I do is if I'm saying this really clear political message, or if I'm, you know, fucking like my exceptionally arrogant early on in my life, I had these kind of arrogant, grandiose ideas that I was going to change people's hearts and minds in terms of what they would vote for and what they believe politically. And like, you know, it was very easy to feel like I'm a crusader. That's my purpose. That's my purpose. And actually, like, my purpose is to connect with people. That's all I've ever wanted to do, you know. And like, there's been times that connection has taken a political form, but also there'll be times that it'll just take other forms, you know. And as long as I'm doing it, I'll be happy, you know. And if I'm doing it, you know, like I said, the pandemic took away in lots of ways the only kind of connection I'd ever known, but I found all these other connections. I found ways to do it online. You know, I think the things that were, the innovations that came up during lockdown were incredible to me. You know, I think there were so many of us that just totally rethought, well, what are, you know, when you strip it all away, what are the bare bones of what we do? And what we need is communion with each other. And if we've got that, we're all going to be much healthier, much happier human beings, I think.
Well, that's a lovely way to end our chat.
I suppose so.
How beautiful.
I didn't mean for it to sound so sort of conclusive, but
Don't ruin it now by like
rambling on. Yeah.
Could you please recommend three songs that people should listen to that are by you?
By me?
When they
Gosh.
Finish listening to this.
Crikey. Yeah. I suppose the obvious one would be Black Tie, which is the song probably more people would have heard of mine than anything else. That's sort of the most well-received thing I've done, which was a song that it's on my album Queer as Folk, which was out in 2018, and it's like a song about being a queer teenager, and it's sort of about being a queer adult as well, and sort of living with that as life goes on, and specifically about being a butch lesbian and always being quite insecure about that in my younger life, and then sort of growing into a grown-up who sort of understands that the reason that I felt insecure about that is because a patriarchal society told me that I don't look like what the male gaze wants women to look like. I feel like since I found that life hack, I have been much happier in myself. So I wrote a song about it, and it's kind of a letter to my teenage self, and that's called Black Tie. And then there's new stuff. There's a song called Storm to Weather. It's the first single from the new album. And that was about the pandemic, about lockdown. But I also think it's about political defeat and the idea that we're all, you know, we're a big team and we're just going to stick it out and we're going to weather the storm and we're going to be here at the end of it because these ideas will never die, you know. So those would be two ones to go for.
The video for that also just looks very, very cold.
Do you know, I really got away with that.
Were you cold?
No, a lot of people said that to me, and I have to fess up and say it was the perfect day for it because the sky was incredibly grey, but it was very, very warm. So like the temperature was really warm, but it was like really moody and grey. So it looks like I did something really brave and like went in and was like, it does, doesn't it? It looks like I did something really tough. I didn't at all. It was like, it was quite warm. The hardest thing about it was that we chose that stretch of beach because So my girlfriend lives in Norwich and she recommended, that's in Haysborough where we recorded that, where we filmed that video. And she recommended that beach because it's normally has incredibly big waves. And we wanted me standing in the sea, holding a guitar, singing the song, getting bashed about by the waves, kind of goes with the lyrics of the song. And for some reason on this day, it's like the only day, I suppose, of the year or whatever, that there was like basically no waves. We got there, it was like warm and still and lovely. So in order to make it look like I'm being bashed by the waves, I had to sort of like sing. I was on my, it looks like I'm standing up in the sea and I'm on, actually on my knees. I'm like kneeling in the very, very shallow, in the very shallow end of the, so I'm sort of being lapped by these very, very gentle waves that kind of only come up to like, if I was standing up, they come up to about my shins.
Right. It looks really good.
Thank you. I mean, talking about the pros and cons of the internet, I kind of, I think like we all live, I think, with the fear of like cancellation every day, and like, what am I going to be cancelled for? You know what I mean? Like, and I think the closest I think I've ever come to cancellation is like the number of people who were like, "What did you do to that guitar?" Because I took a guitar into the sea, and there were so many people who were like, and so honestly, I would say the ratio of people saying, "I like this song," to people saying, "Is that guitar okay?" It was like a 1-to-1 ratio. Like as many people worried about the guitar as there were saying like, "Good job on the song." So that's two, Black Tie, Stormed Weather. And then I guess I'd go for the second single for this record as well. It's like a country song. Sort of a bit of a like, is pastiche the right word? Like a bit of a sort of send up of the kind of traditional sad country music thing, to really sort of lean into that idea. We did like a barn dance, line dancing video shoot, which is quite a lot of fun, and that's called The Last Man on Earth, which is like about kind of, yeah, being kind of falling for a straight friend and like never being able to sort of realize those feelings. Yeah, it's one of those songs that, again, like, I mean, I wrote it quite a long time ago, but it's one of those ones that, again, I feel like since my improved understanding of the way that jaded, embittered men have written the story of the world, I'm a bit like, oh god, it's just so lame. It's so lame. But yeah, I shouldn't say that, because I've had a couple of very nice messages from people being like, this is exactly how I feel about my friend. And again, I just want to be like, yeah, move on. Move on.
Well, yeah, so, maybe this can help them move on.
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, my advice to those people is, go to therapy, meet a nice queer girl, you'll be fine. That's what happened to me.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sorted.
Yeah. That makes it sound like I met my girlfriend at therapy. I just mean, have some therapy, you will stop choosing people who are completely and utterly self-sabotaging to your happiness.
Yes.
That's,
yeah, definitely. Definitely words to live by there. Finally, if you could give one piece of advice to a listener who wants to be more creative in their own life, what would that piece of advice be?
Oh, you know what? I would always say, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. I think try and try and try, you'll get better. I think one of the things, another, I guess, consequence of the internet is that, like, I think we all feel like everything we do is carved in stone now forever, you know, because everything we do, we put online, and then it's kind of, it can be viewed by so many people, and it's sort of, we feel like it's this very permanent record, you know, but like, it kind of isn't. You put something online, you can take it down if you stop being happy with it. But also B, you know, like we said earlier on, like it's all a journey, like we're all improving all the time. And I think that, like, I learned on the job from gigs, and I'm still learning. I'm always learning, and you know, I never have a gig where I don't feel like I learned something and hopefully become better from the end of it. So I think, like, you know, like crack on, never feel like you have to wait until you're perfect. You know, I mean, I think I recorded as soon as I had like 10 songs that were even finished, I just was like, let's get these down on an album. And that was my first album. And like, you know, I don't think much of it now, but it's nice to be able to look back and be like, I'm 11 years better than I was then. Do you know what I mean? So I think try and DIY. You don't need anybody's permission to do anything. You know, that's the wonderful thing about the age that we live in. You know, like, you will find your audience. They will definitely be out there, and you have the means to connect to them wherever you are. That's a beautiful thing. And it's a privilege that not everybody had. I mean, think how many musicians, artists, creators that there were in previous decades before there was this wonderful tool that we have to self-publish and find people who will like our stuff, you know, wherever they will be, because they're out there, you know, they're out there. So yeah, I'd say DIY till I die. That'd be my advice, I think.
Me too.
Yeah, for sure.
100%. Yeah. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you.
Because we were going to do this before the stupid pandemic.
We were, yeah.
I think it was just as it started. I set out a week where I was like, this thing seems to be approaching, but I know I'll spend a week driving up and down the country. That's what I was going to do. I was going to come and meet you halfway between Leicester and here or something.
I was going to
go up north to speak to Ginger. Yeah, I was going to go and see Miles. So like, I had all this plan, and then everyone was like, maybe not.
Yeah.
Let's not do that. And then we just did it all remote. But I'm so glad we managed to do this. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm so glad as well. Yeah, yeah. No, lovely to talk to you. And I mean, if we had done it before the pandemic, I guess I wouldn't have had anything to say. So I feel like everything I said was like, I've really learned in the past 18 months, you know. But yeah, I mean, yeah. Like I said, it's all a learning curve. Life's a learning journey.
Well, exactly. And if you hadn't put that record out 10 years ago, and if I hadn't put my record out in 2010, then we wouldn't have made the things we've made now.
That's true.
If we'd just sat around waiting to be perfect, like you say, it wouldn't be the same. So,
yeah, you know,
we did it all brilliantly, is what I'm saying. We aced it.
We did. And I'd rather, you know, like, how much worse would it be to turn around and be like, fuck, I was loads better in 2010 than I am now.
Yes.
That's the alternative at the end of the day. You know, you're either improving or you're declining.
May we continue to improve.
Let's hope so, yeah.
Like a fine wine. If you do one thing for independent music today, please make that ordering Grace's new album, Connectivity. Head to gracepetrie.com for all the info and sign up to her mailing list while you're there. The deluxe show notes page for this episode is at penfriend.rocks/grace, and you can grab 2 free Penfriend songs there as a gift. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. And I do try not to bang on about this too often, but please consider leaving a review of the show on Apple Podcasts, because that really helps spread the word. Thanks for considering it. Big love to my Correspondence Club for powering the making of this show and all my music. And if you're not a member yet, visit my website for information on joining our friendly group. If you'd like to keep listening to Attention Engineer now, I recommend episode 6 with Tom Robinson and episode 4 with Frank Turner as good follow-on listens. I'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 50, the last one until next year, so make sure you click subscribe to listen first. Have a fab day, take care, and thanks for listening.